Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Nell Bernstein. She is the author of a wonderful new book called Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. She is also the author previously of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, and she coordinates the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership. Nell Bernstein, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
I'm glad to be here.
Juvenile prison, why burn it down? Why get rid of it? Why not fix it and make it work better?
Well, you know, I set out to report the book with exactly that idea, that it was an institution that had some serious problems, and I would unearth those and look for ways to fix them. But the more I learned both about what's currently taking place in these institutions and the history of violence and abuse and failure, as well as the history of serial failed reform, I honestly began to despair in the idea of reforming an institution that to me came to seem intrinsically flawed.
So it was actually facts that swayed you in one direction. It's funny that people seem to think we should choose between being revolutionaries or reformists as if it were a personality choice rather than something you base on the facts of the matter.
That's exactly right. You know, it just seems like a very practical place to come to. For instance, when I learned that in confidential polling, 80 to 90% of all American teenagers, it turns out, acknowledge having committed an act of delinquency serious enough under the law to get them locked up. And I think if we look back at our adolescence, that begins to make a little more sense. But most of them aren't locked up. And those who aren't very often just kind of grow out of the impulsivity that led to the delinquency in the first place. The kids who don't grow out of it are the kids we incarcerate. In fact, the greatest predictor that somebody will grow up to become an adult criminal and an adult prisoner is juvenile incarceration. And that's when you control for delinquency and everything else. So then it just kind of becomes a matter of common sense. This is an intervention that is not only helping, it's doing a lot of harm, not just to the kids, but in terms of public safety. So yes, you're right. It's not an ideology for me. It just began to seem like common sense.
I think it bears repeating because it's an incredible analysis that if you left kids committing crimes alone, they would be less likely to go on to a life of criminal activity than if you put them in a juvenile prison. So it's worse than nothing.
Well, you know, look, we test that thesis every day, and the way we test it is by not arresting and not incarcerating white kids. You know, I mean, that's where the dividing line is in terms of who gets arrested and incarcerated for the same acts. And that takes something that is an immense practical and humanitarian failure and turns it into also a tremendous injustice.
Is it just disproportionately racial minorities who are arrested and charged and incarcerated, or is it actually a majority of those incarcerated?
I think I would use the word disproportionate over majority, but the disproportionality is quite extreme, and it gets more extreme the deeper a kid goes into the system. So, you know, you take your two hypothetical kids, one white, one black. The black child is more likely to get arrested, but even more likely to be detained instead of sent home. And then after that, even more likely to be sentenced to a term of incarceration than probation or something. So that the deeper and deeper you get into the system, the greater these inequities grow. So that, you know, I think it's pretty well known that blacks and whites use drugs and sell drugs at about the same rate. But a black teenager is 48 times more likely to be locked up for the same drug offense as a white teenager. So that's when I think you're not talking about, even disparities doesn't seem like quite a strong enough term to me.
Yeah, 48 times more likely. And how many young people in this country are being locked up, and how does it compare to the past and to other countries?
Well, that's where the question of do we reform or not becomes really interesting, because at the moment we're witnessing a pretty significant decline in the number of young people who are locked up in this country, a decline of about 40% over the course of a decade to maybe 68,000. So it becomes awfully easy to argue that we're moving in the right direction and what's all the fuss about. But, you know, if you're one of those 68,000 and there's a 1 in 10 chance that you're going to be sexually abused by a guard, there's, I don't even know the percent, but there's a tremendous chance that your future will be derailed by this intervention, then a 40% drop just starts looking inadequate. You know, I think of it as like the guy who goes into family court and says to the judge, you know, I'm beating my kids 40% less. Can I have them back? It's just not good enough.
No, when you come to see it as a crime and an abuse rather than an imperfect system, you have to end it. How long has this basic system of juvenile incarceration been around, and how long has the effort to reform it been around?
Well, the answer to both of those questions is identical, and that was another real surprise to me. The first institutions for juveniles were the houses of refuge in the early 1800s, and the traditional narrative is that the juvenile court was formed with a benign and rehabilitative intent, and it's only in the sort of tough-on-crime 90s that has slipped away and been replaced by a punitive ethos. But if you look at what actually has happened in these institutions, going back to the 1800s, before there even was an official juvenile court, you see things like the ducking stool. You see stories of kids being beaten, rented out as chattel labor. So that narrative of a once grand system gone bad is actually just not true. And again, that to me raises the question of why. What is it about locking kids and adults up behind walls where the rest of society can't see them and giving one group total control over the other that seems to be sort of intrinsically corrupting?
There were experiments at Stanford, I believe, along these lines. What was your answer when you asked that question?
Yeah, the Stanford prison experiments involved telling one group of students that they were the prisoners and another group that they were the guards. And the experiment had to be ended after a few days because the guards became so drunk on power that they were endangering their fellow students. And that's a real caution in demonizing the guards. In fact, I met guards who were tremendously kind, who organized softball leagues on their time off. So, but then at the same time, you know, I'm talking to kids who have had a pepper spray fogger sprayed directly in their eyes, and reading about kids who are made to run in the heat carrying a log until they vomit, at which point they have to eat their own vomit. So how do you reconcile these two pictures? I talked to several people trying to probe that question of what is it about the prison environment that makes us hurt our kids. I had a research assistant, a young man named Will Roy, who's a UC Berkeley student, but also spent some time inside the California Youth Authority. And I remember asking him this question, and we were sitting in a coffee shop, and he said, you know, you have to remember this is their job, and we are the raw materials for their job. So if I worked in this coffee shop and the espresso machine broke down, I'd be mad. We're just the espresso machine. You know, we're not human to them. And I thought that was a pretty profound answer.
We are speaking with Nell Bernstein, the author of a tremendous new book called Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. You know, Nell, I wrote a review of your book, a very positive, and I got lots of comments back, and you never know if the commenters read just the headline or the review, but the most popular question, I think, my fault or otherwise, was, well, then what do we do with the scary, monstrous beasts that are currently locked up in the juvenile prisons if we don't lock them up there? What's your answer?
Not your fault. It's an inevitable question, and it's a completely fair question. And, you know, of course, I get asked it, too. And I think the first thing is a caveat. We sort of assume that once a kid is wearing that orange uniform, he is a scary, terrible monster. The majority of kids we lock up, and the great, great majority of those we lock up for the first time, are very low-level offenders. So, you know, truants, loiterers, maybe a kid with a marijuana charge or public drunkenness. So they're not, can't remember who first said this, but they're kids that we're mad at, not kids that we're scared of. That said, young people do commit very serious crimes. I think that what we have to think about is that if they enter the juvenile justice system, they come back. And the question is, do we want them to come back from wherever we send them or whatever intervention we choose, healed and less likely to continue to act violently, or further traumatized and more likely to commit violence? And all the evidence is that the traditional prison has the latter. In Missouri, a lot of people hold the Missouri system up as a model, because they got rid of all the large facilities and replaced them with small, semi-home-like settings. But even more than that, train the staff to form relationships with the kids. And they have success with some very serious offenders. So do programs like multisystemic therapy and other programs that leave the kid in the community but give her a caseworker 24 hours to work out not just her problems, but her family's and the disconnect with the school. So there are models that actually have much more success with scary kids. We're just not using them.
And those models tend to rely on personal relationships and keeping the kid out of incarceration?
Well, personal relationships, I came to feel, are the bottom line. And I think anyone who is a parent or has had a parent or knows a child kind of gets this, that children not only are rehabilitated but grow and thrive in the context of trusting relationships with adults. And if we do know that, the fact that our first line intervention when a kid steps out of the communal norms and breaks the law is to isolate that child starts looking pretty counterintuitive.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact in your book that solitary confinement can lead to suicide, and yet is used as a punishment, among other things, for suicidal tendencies.
Yeah, that's one of those, is irony even the word, that you see pretty frequently. But yeah, I did talk to, you know, for instance, a young woman who the girl next to her was talking about suicide, and the equivalent of a SWAT team came into her cell, stripped her naked, and tossed her into a solitary cell with nothing but a single blanket. And the official rationale isn't punishment. It's that this is needed to keep a suicidal team safe. But it's a pretty weak rationale given data showing that suicides are far more common in solitary confinement than in the general population.
Can ignorance and stupidity explain that, or is there a motivation of cruelty and sadism that's needed to explain such counterproductive approaches?
Well, you keep asking the really hard question.
I'm
sorry. It's one that really troubled me. I'm not inclined to believe in evil. I'm not inclined to believe in bad seeds, whether they're kids or adults, and yet we have these things happening. I asked that question everywhere I went. And like me, many people were stumped by it. But I think of Vinnie Schiraldi, who was then the head of probation in New York and had run the juvenile system in D.C., which, as he described it, was in pretty terrible shape when he arrived. And he talked about cognitive dissonance among newly hired guards, that you come in with, you know, a do-gooder attitude, the idea that you're going to help these kids. And the first time you see some of your more experienced colleagues selling drugs to the kids or doing something else that really challenges your values, in a split second, you have to decide whether to object, whether to snitch, and the sort of no-snitch mentality is quite prevalent among the guards, as much so as among the youth, or whether to just kind of keep quiet. And as Vinnie put it, if you choose to keep quiet, that first time a little bit of evil has crept in, and it makes it that much easier the second time to keep quiet. And, you know, eventually you just reconcile yourself to the idea that this is the way it is. The other thing that I came to believe is that, I'm not sure what's cause and what's effect, but every aspect of the prison experience is designed to dehumanize. A kid comes in and trades his clothes for a uniform, trades his name for a number, trades his home and community for this very stark, cold environment where he's allowed very few personal possessions. Often they have to march around military style. And I think once you dehumanize someone to that degree, it then becomes possible to transgress against them in ways that wouldn't have been imaginable. One young man described being transferred to a new facility just as a large-scale fight broke out, and as a consequence, he and his whole unit were forced to kneel for as long as 2 weeks with their hands cuffed behind them, all in a long row. And if they didn't make it to the twice-daily bathroom break, they were left to clean it up themselves. And he said that, you know, it was physically painful, it was psychologically difficult, but what made him lose his faith in God was listening to the guards just sort of joke and banter as these young men knelt suffering before them, as if they were just invisible, as if there were no common humanity among them. And I think that's a part of what makes some of this possible as well.
It's such a striking parallel with war, with what it takes to get a soldier to do as ordered in war, and how the other side is dehumanized in war. And in Guantanamo, they call those stress positions. But much of what we see both in lawless prisons like Guantanamo and in U.S. prisons, which are supposed to be under a rule of law, are what would be violations of Geneva Conventions if prisoners of war were treated thus. So deprivation of food, stress positions, lack of sleep, forced nudity, attacks with dogs. I think a lot of us imagine in juvenile prisons, if things go wrong, it's because bad prisoners are attacking other prisoners. But the understanding I get from your book is that the majority of the abuse and the torture is by the guards.
Well, first off, I think your analogy is really important. It's no coincidence that we had a war on drugs, or that we invented the super predator, just as we invented a caricature of the Jap in World War II. And I hadn't really thought about that before. But the analogy unfortunately works. The question is why we would want to be at war with our own children. You know, I don't want to leave the impression that there's not ward-on-ward violence, because there is, and I'm happy to talk about that. At the same time, you are putting your finger on a tremendous misconception. For example, I think we've all heard a don't drop the soap joke, right, in reference to prison. But federal investigations have found that on average, 12% of kids who are locked up are raped or sexually abused. Of those, 2 out of 100 are abused by another ward, and 10 out of 100, or 1 in 10, are abused by a guard. whoever is abusing you, it's traumatic. But I think when it's the adult in charge, it's also morally corrosive, you know, and confusing. In a culture of violence, there's going to be violence of all sorts. And I'm not saying that a juvenile prison is just sort of 24/7 mayhem. Often walking around these places, the strongest thing that I felt was these waves of boredom, just this enforced idleness. But you also have stories, for example, in California, of what were called Friday night fights, where guards would take young men from rival gangs and kind of pen them together in a locked cell and watch them fight as their evening entertainment. And there is a pressure to prove oneself. You know, you're either a victim or a perp. So I think that the abuse, yeah, the violence on the part of the guards is by far the most corrosive, but there is also fighting among the kids.
And of course, we're paying the guards for that and paying them. Another thing that struck me in your book, at least 8 times to incarcerate a child in this country as compared to what we pay to educate a child in this country.
Yeah, and that's just on average. The average cost per year to incarcerate a child is about $88,000, and the average cost to educate a child is about $10,000. But in some places, like California, where I live, the average cost per year to incarcerate reached $225,000, while the cost to educate dropped to $8,000 and something. And young people are aware of that. They're not blind to any part of this, including the politics. And I think the message that sends them is, we will spend anything to contain you, but nothing to cultivate you.
Are free young people aware of it? Are young people getting a lousy education aware of where the money's going instead?
Yeah, and, you know, poor young people of color in particular will say things like, they've got a bed waiting for me. But that's the plan for them. That's a pretty widely held sentiment.
And so when you say that there are cuts happening and that there's been a reduction by 40% in this horror enterprise, is the financial cost the primary driving factor there?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that there are a combination of drivers. There's been some pretty aggressive work on the part of the Department of Justice. There's been some amazing grassroots advocacy. There have been some huge scandals. But when it comes down to it, it took state budget crises to really get this train moving. And that's promising, but it's also worrisome, because unless we have a shift in values to accompany this shift in numbers, there's no reason to believe that when the economy gets a bit better, we will find a reason to fill these cells up again. I think the real challenge is moving public opinion so that it becomes a matter of values and a matter of valuing kids and not just a financial issue. Although the public already is moving in that direction quite quickly, if you look at polling results.
Does the creation of new facts help? The fact that these prisons are being cut and crime is not increasing and kids are doing better without them? Or is the accumulation of facts far and above what's needed already?
I mean, if I hear of another Blue Ribbon Commission, I think I'm just going to pop. It's stunning the degree to which facts don't create change, or at least don't in the short run. I think that the advocates who have dedicated themselves to this just have been tremendously persistent, because otherwise these facts just kind of drop into the news hole. Dozier, a facility in Florida, got a lot of press a few years ago when a group of men who had been boys there came out together and started talking about a place called the White House, which was a little shed where they were taken for beatings so severe that they remembered seeing pieces of flesh and lips on the wall. They also remembered going into the building with a friend and leaving alone. So finally in 2011, Florida closed the facility, but with no admission that there was a problem there, just, you know, citing a reorganization and fiscal issues. And again, when I looked into it more deeply, I found that the first investigation of Dozier took place in 1903, and 12 investigations followed, and all of those revealed the same horrors that this quote-unquote scandal that emerged recently revealed. So whether it's facts about an individual institution or just, you know, social science and the question of what works don't seem to be driving this train. And then that raises the question, what is? What do we get from these facilities if we don't get the things that we say we want, like rehabilitated kids and safer streets? Then psychologically, what are we getting from continuing to do this? And that's something I thought about a lot and haven't quite come to an answer.
We are almost out of time, I'm very sad to say, but I have a theory I want to run by you quickly as to why this is a bigger problem in some people's minds than we might think, and that is that just about everything that your book explains is wrong about locking up kids is also wrong about locking up adults. And coming to that realization can be scary and make the problem seem bigger. Am I way off track there?
No. I mean, I think the sort of slippery slope feeling is part of the political landscape. I do think that public attitudes are changing at the adult level, too, around things like mandatory minimums and drug laws. But there's been nothing like the population drop that there's been at the youth level. And most of what I have told you is also true about adults. So, yeah, that makes a scary kind of sense.
Or a recipe for positive change in the years to come. In any event, I strongly recommend that everyone listening pick up a copy of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison by Nell Bernstein. Nell, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure. Great questions.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.